Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Welcome to Intelligent Design the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting with Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. In this podcast, we're going to discuss another excerpt from my article, Zeal for Darwin's House Consumes Them, How Supporters of Evolution Encourage Violations of the Establishment Clause, published in Liberty University Law Review earlier this year. The article analyzes the decision in the case CF v. Capistrano Unified School District. In that case, a federal district court judge in Southern California found that a teacher, Corbett, violated the First Amendment by attacking the religious viewpoint of creationism in a public school classroom. To give a preview of my argument, this section of my article concludes that either a viewpoint is religious and thereby unconstitutional to advocate as correct or critique as false in public schools, or it is scientific and fair game for both advocacy and critique in public schools. In this present author's view, creationism should be considered a religious viewpoint that can neither be advocated as true nor critiqued as false in public schools, and intelligent design should be considered a scientific viewpoint that is fair game for both advocacy and critique in public schools. Whatever the solution is, there is presently a gross lack of legal symmetry and an overabundance of jurisprudential hypocrisy if a public school teacher cannot legally say that creationism or ID are scientifically correct, but can call these viewpoints scientifically incorrect or nonsense. If selective enforcement of the law is a hallmark of tyranny, then we should be exceedingly troubled by both the constitutional implications and hypocrisy of the evolution lobby, behavior that opposes advocating ID and creationism on the grounds that they are religious viewpoints, but expressly endorses public schools inhibiting, opposing, and disapproving of those purported religious viewpoints. The excerpt from my article expands this argument. The Kitzmiller v. Dover plaintiffs and the district court ruling they won that declared ID unconstitutional relied heavily on the Lemon Test, which requires that the principal or primary effect of a law must be one that neither advances nor inhibits religion. The Lemon Test would seem to prohibit government inhibition of religion with the same measure of force with which it bans the advancement of religion. For, as the Ninth Circuit held, quote, the government neutrality required under the Establishment Clause is violated as much by government disapproval of religion as it is by government approval of religion, unquote. Yet few cases have applied the inhibition of religion doctrine, as one federal appellate court lamented, quote, because it is far more typical for an Establishment Clause case to challenge instances in which the government has done something which favors religion or a particular religious group, we have little guidance concerning what constitutes a primary effect of inhibiting religion, unquote. Nonetheless, that same court observed that, quote, although Lemon is most frequently invoked in cases involving alleged government preference to religion, the test also accommodates the analysis of a claim brought under a hostility to religion theory, unquote. The doctrine prohibiting government inhibition of religion can be traced to some significant U.S. Supreme Court cases. In the landmark case, School District of Abington Township v. Shemp, the U.S. Supreme Court recognized that, quote, the state may not establish a religion of secularism in the sense of affirmatively opposing or showing hostility to religion, thus preferring those who believe in no religion over those who do believe, unquote. As noted in Epperson, the court likewise held that the state, quote, may not adopt programs or practices in its public schools or colleges which aid or oppose any religion. This prohibition is absolute, unquote. Consistent with this principle, in Board of Education of Westside Community Schools v. Mergence, the court ruled that state action is impermissible when it would, quote, demonstrate not neutrality but hostility toward religion, unquote. Likewise, the endorsement test prohibits disapproval of religion. Assuming, ad arguendo, that ID's critics are correct in holding that ID is a religious viewpoint, then it should be not only unconstitutional for the government to advance ID, but also to inhibit ID. If ID is a religious viewpoint, the government may not violate the absolute prohibition against opposing it or showing hostility or disapproval towards it. ID critic Jay Wexler argues that public school teachers could send a message of disapproval towards religious views on origins if they suggest that, quote, such beliefs are irrational or primitive compared with scientific views or make explicit first-person statements disapproving of religious viewpoints, unquote. Many textbooks have certainly met such a standard of disapproval towards ID. Yet ID's critics have expressed no apparent qualms about public schools showing hostility towards ID. In fact, the Kitzmiller complaint explicitly lamented to the judge that under Dover's ID policy, quote, students will not be told of any flaws or weaknesses in intelligent design, much less that the scientific community does not consider it valid science, unquote. Apparently, the Kitzmiller plaintiffs saw no negative constitutional ramifications of teaching public school students about the flaws or weaknesses in the alleged, quote, specific religious viewpoint and beliefs encompassed by the assertion or argument of intelligent design, unquote. Would such instruction be constitutional? One lower court has attempted to address this question with respect to the critique of creationism, which is different from ID, in a public school. In the spring of 2009, a federal district court in Southern California issued a ruling in CF v. Capistrano Unified School District, where student-parent plaintiffs Farnan filed suit after a history teacher, Corbett, made various statements during in-class instruction that Farnan found objectionable, including some instruction that allegedly disparaged creationism. In balancing the interests of the parties, Judge James E. Selna recognized the complexity of the question, which reflected, quote, a tension between the constitutional rights of a student and the demands of higher education as reflected in the Advanced Placement European History course in which Farnan enrolled, unquote. The judge continued, quote, it also reflects a tension between Farnan's deeply held religious beliefs and the need for government, particularly schools, to carry out their duties free of the strictures of any particular religious or philosophical belief system. The Constitution recognizes both sides of the equation, unquote. Regarding Corbett's free speech rights as a teacher, the court noted that, quote, to the extent that Farnan is arguing that Corbett may not put forth secular ideas because he would be creating a secular religion, Farnan's argument fails, unquote. The court stated that its ruling thus therefore, quote, reflects the constitutionally permissible need for expansive discussion even if a topic may be offensive to our particular religion or if a particular religion takes one side of historical debate, but that the decision also reflects that there are boundaries to the permissibility of such district-sponsored speech. As to Farnan's right, the court observed that, quote, the state may not affirmatively show hostility to religion, unquote. The court's analysis thus asked whether, quote, when looking at the context as a whole, a reasonable observer would perceive the primary effect of Corbett's statements as disapproving of religion in general or of Christianity in particular, unquote. Some of Corbett's controversial statements regarding creationism included one, quote, I will not leave John Pelosa alone to propagandize kids with this religious, superstitious nonsense, unquote. And two, quote, there is as much evidence that God did it as there is that there is a giant spaghetti monster living behind the moon who did it. Therefore, no creation unless you invoke magic. Science does not invoke magic. If we cannot explain something, we do not uphold that position. It's not ooh, therefore magic. That's not the way we work. Contrast that with creationists. They never try to disprove creationism. They're all running around trying to prove it. That's deduction. It's not science. Scientifically, it's nonsense. Unquote. The court held that Statement 1 ran afoul of the Establishment Clause, but that Statement 2 was constitutionally permissible. When Corbett stated an unequivocal belief that creationism is superstitious nonsense, the court found that this primarily sends a message of disapproval of religion or creationism and therefore constitutes improper disapproval of religion in violation of the Establishment Clause. The court found that Corbett could have criticized the other teacher who had taught creationism without disparaging those views. At the very least, then, it seems unconstitutional to critique religious viewpoints when the statements entail disparagement that is unnecessary or superfluous to the academic critique itself. While the holding in CF in some sense validates this article's contention that there comes a point where critique of creationism is no longer constitutional, there is much room for criticism of the ruling. As noted, the court found that calling creationism superstitious nonsense is unconstitutional, but calling it scientifically nonsense is permissible. Is this a distinction without a difference? The court found that Statement 2 was permissible because in its context, Corbett was merely seeking to, quote, distinguish generally accepted scientific reasoning from religious belief, unquote, and showing that, quote, the generally accepted scientific principles do not logically lead to the theory of creationism, unquote. In essence, the court held that Statement 2 was permissible because Corbett was merely explaining why creationism is not scientific. Such instruction undoubtedly should be considered a legitimate endeavor for a public school teacher, for one can explain why a viewpoint is unscientific and religious without taking a position on the ultimate veracity of that view or without critiquing that view as false. In this regard, Corbett's instruction in Statement 2 might have been constitutional had it actually fit the court's description. But when allegedly trying to convey that creationism is unscientific and religious, Corbett equated the belief in creationism with belief in magic, or a giant spaghetti monster living behind the moon, and then called creationism scientifically nonsense. Was all of this necessary? When a public school teacher compares religious viewpoints to such outlandishly false and nonsensical fictions as the flying spaghetti monster, whatever the purpose, the objective, reasonable observer would undoubtedly perceive a primary effect that is disapproving. Court's Statement 2 seems to entail superfluous disagreement that is unnecessary to the critique itself, and certainly seems to meet Wexler's standard of denigrating religious viewpoints as irrational or primitive compared with scientific views. At the very least, then, Corbett could have easily explained why creationism is unfalsifiable and therefore unscientific without disparaging those views. By placing creationism on par with obviously false and nonsensical viewpoints, Corbett was not only portraying it as unfalsifiable, but also implying creationism is false, in effect employing the unfalsifiable false fallacy which plagues so many other treatments of creationism in public school curricula. But there is a deeper concern here beyond the CF Court's apparent failure to properly analyze the facts under its interpretation of the law. As noted in this article, courts have consistently held that advocating creationism in public schools is unconstitutional. In this regard, this present author agrees with courts that there are certain core tenets of creationism, namely its adherence to supernatural or divine forces, which make it an unscientific and untestable religious viewpoint that cannot be constitutionally advocated in public schools. That having been said, there is a glaring asymmetry in the law when courts hold, on the one hand, that creationism cannot be advocated in public schools because it is not science, but on the other hand hold that it can be disparaged as scientifically nonsense also because it is not science. To put it another way, those who desire legal symmetry will find the law sorely lacking if advocating creationism is prohibited on the grounds that it is religion, but nonetheless courts permit public schools to critique, attack, and oppose these views as false. When the government takes an affirmative position on the truth or falsity of a religious viewpoint, it is on dangerous constitutional ground. As the U.S. Supreme Court unequivocally held, quote, "If there is any fixed star in our constitutional constellation, it is that no official, high or petty, can prescribe what shall be orthodox in politics, nationalism, religion, or other matters of opinion," unquote. In other words, it is one thing to explain why a purported religious viewpoint is unfalsifiable and therefore unscientific, but quite another to state or imply that the viewpoint is objectively and scientifically false. Yet, as documented in this article, this latter offense is precisely what many textbooks do with regards to intelligent design or creationism. Courts cannot treat these viewpoints like religion in order to strike down their advocacy, but then treat them like science or ignore thinly veiled attempts like Corbett's to paint them as false when they are being critiqued in order to sanction their disapproval. Either a viewpoint is religious and thereby unconstitutional to advocate as correct or critique as false in public schools, or it is scientific and fair game for both advocacy and critique in public schools. In this present author's view, creationism should be considered a religious viewpoint that can be neither advocated as true nor critiqued as false in public schools. But intelligent design should be considered a scientific viewpoint that is fair game for both advocacy and critique in public schools. Whatever the solution is, there is presently a gross lack of legal symmetry and an overabundance of jurisprudential hypocrisy if a public school teacher cannot legally say that creationism or intelligent design are scientifically correct, but can call these views scientifically incorrect or nonsense. If selective enforcement of the law is a hallmark of tyranny, then we should be exceedingly troubled by both the constitutional implications and hypocrisy of the evolution lobby, behavior that opposes advocating ID and creationism on the grounds that they are religious viewpoints, but expressly endorses public schools inhibiting, opposing, and disapproving of those purported religious viewpoints. Again, this article can be found at discovery.org. I'm Casey Luskin with ID the Future Podcast. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2010. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.